Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on traditional Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe territory at CFRC. We're your hosts, Dana Wesley
and Graham Juneau.
In this edition,
C279 is a bill at the federal level which would add gender identity into the list of protected grounds under the Canadian Human Rights Act.
To me, TransCanada and a lot of these pipeline companies don't have a good track record in my mind because of all these ruptures and spills.
It certainly added a sense of silence on campus, or threatening silence on campus.
But first, here are the headlines.
An anti-Line 9 protest took place in London, Ontario on March 31st. Protesters marched down Dundas Street with a giant cloth black snake. Ed von Adderkas of CHRW spoke with one of the organizers, Roberta Corey.
The Line 9 snake is out of black fabric. It has a big cardboard puppet head, and it's to represent the Line 9 pipeline, which is our neighbor just north of London. It was made by a whole bunch of volunteers, and it has like drops of shiny fabric like trailing oil. It's held up by one puppeteer, holds up the head, which is about 2 feet by 2 feet, and then there's 11 other puppeteers with dowels, 4-foot dowels, that hold up the rest of the body, so it's 30 feet long.
The National Energy Board approved the Line 9 reversal on March 6th. Communities along the pipeline are continuing to protest the decision, and some people are calling for an independent environmental assessment.
So really what we're asking is that there be an independent environmental assessment. We want Premier Wynne to demand that and to not allow that Line 9 to reverse and start working until there has been an independent environmental review. The National Energy Board members are people with backgrounds in the oil industry. And then they also are telling us that it's for our own energy needs in Ontario and Quebec. But in reality, there's a lot of talk of a new pipeline being built right down the coast that would cross the border into the United States and go through New York, possibly Maine. There's talk of shipping it overseas from there. So we're quite sure that they're not being upfront and revealing the real purpose behind this pipeline.
Our next headline was written by Amélie Philipson from CKUT in Montreal.
Amnesty International has recently launched their fourth campaign against torture. A conference was organized in Montreal on Tuesday, March 25th. One of the speakers was Damien Corsetti, former soldier in the United States Army. He served as an interrogator at the Bagram prison in Afghanistan and Abu Ghraib in Iraq. During his time at Bagram, Corsetti was in contact with Canadian citizen Omar Khad. Omar was one of the youngest captives at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. At the time, he was 15 years old. Omar Khad was accused of war crimes, murder in violation of the law of war, and providing material support for terrorism. Canada has refused to seek extradition repatriation of Omar, despite the urgings of Amnesty International and of the Canadian Bar Association. Damien Corsetti speaks about him.
Now I'd like to speak a little bit about Omar Khadr. Chilman is a very unique case to me based on his age at his time of capture. He was 15 and by all accounts a child soldier and should be afforded protection as such. I feel that by charging and detaining Mr. Khadr for war crimes, the world has failed him as a child of humanity. There are many aspects of U.S. policy that can be looked at as subjective, but this issue is not one of them. It is a black and white. Omar Khadr was a child soldier, and I feel it's my responsibility to never be silent the injustice given to him by the U.S. and Canadian governments. What good are treaties and laws if our governments only work to exploit loopholes or choose to ignore them altogether? It is for this reason I've chosen to work with Amnesty International in its 2014 campaign against torture to hold accountable those who would make policy to subvert laws written to protect our fellow men and women and further deteriorate the cause of humanity.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
I'm
You just heard Same Sun by Dorothea Poss from the tape Athirst.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
Our first feature is by Ed von Adercas at CHRW in London about Bill C-279.
Bill 279 is a piece of legislation currently before the Senate that hopes to extend human rights protection to include gender identity. Kristen Malloy is a Toronto-based activist and writer who's been pushing for the bill to get into law.
C-279 is a bill at the federal level which would add gender identity into the list of protected grounds under the Canadian Human Rights Act. It's very important that we list it specifically, explicitly, rather than implicitly. Right now, it's only covered under sex, and only because the people in charge at the Human Rights Commission have decided that that's the case. But in the past, it has been judged in the 80s and 90s not to be covered by sex, and really a change of guard at the Human Rights Organization could result in our cases being thrown out again. So it's very critical that we get that protection codified into law, and that's what C-279 is all about.
The passage last year of Bill 279 into the Senate should have been cause for some celebration, but there is a problem. This piece of legislation has already been to the Senate once before and got thrown out with the rest of the pending bills when the last election came around.
It's gone through the House of Commons more than once, actually. This is not the first session of Parliament that has passed this bill to give us human rights protection. And this is the previous occasion. It also died in the Senate when the election was called. It looks like that may happen again, and we're all very concerned about that. The problem with 279 is that conservatives have filibustered it and used a number of different political tricks in order to delay or reschedule voting and debate on 279. So it's been knocked back repeatedly. In fact, when Harper prorogued Parliament last year, it had already gone through more than one reading in the Senate. It was kicked back to start and delayed again. So there's a very real possibility that the bill may not pass before the election in 2015.
Michelle Boyce is a local London human rights activist. She's hopeful that action will be taken eventually.
Considering the number of months that has passed without any movement within the Senate on this bill, I would agree with her assessment that it is likely that this will die on paper with the next election, but we will continue the advocacy. We will continue putting pressure on the Senate to pass the bill, and like all political movements and all political advocacy, all we need is one major press incident that can put pressure on the Conservatives to move the bill along, to make it politically viable for them, and the bill will pass. So I'm moderately hopeful still that we can find a way to push it through Senate.
The problem, Boyce says, is with our political system.
It's ridiculous that a bill can get through the House of Commons twice and not receive Senate approval. I mean, that just says that our political system is not working, and the elected officials in this country have twice approved this bill, and the non-elected senators have stalled it both times. So it's ridiculous that our democratic process is being held hostage by non-elected people in the upper chambers. It's supposed to be second sight, not whatever our current Senate is doing with bills. I mean, with the Senate reform bills that are keep dying in the Senate, all we need is one of those bills to come forward and get through. And if we could get the Senate nonpartisan, then getting bills like this through the Senate would be much easier. And
all right, so what can listeners who are concerned about this do to help this bill get through? I mean, we're not senators, but is there a way we could exercise pressure? Or
So we're encouraging all Canadians to write emails or call their senators and other senators to tell them that, you know, human rights protection for every single person in the country equally is a value that Canadians share, and that we need those senators to pass 279. Now is definitely the time for, you know, trans rights are human rights, and every person is entitled to the same dignity and the same protection as any other person, and And this is an important step that we need to make in order for Canada to be a leader in human rights.
From CHW for Groundwire, I'm Ed von Attercass.
There's been growing worries in Winnipeg and surrounding regions about TransCanada Corporation's Energy East pipeline. CKUW producer Michael Welch spoke recently to Crystal Green, a young First Nations filmmaker and activist, about her concerns with the pipeline.
In Winnipeg and surrounding regions over the last several months, there's been a growing awareness over a pipeline project called Energy East. It's being championed by the pipeline company TransCanada Corporation, the same company behind the proposed Keystone XL pipeline to the United States. Energy East, as proposed, would move 1.1 million barrels a day of Alberta tar sands crude along a 4,600-kilometer route extending from Alberta to terminals in eastern Canada. Consequently, resistance has begun to take form along the pipeline route, with frontline activists expressing concerns both about contributing to climate change and about the adverse impacts on communities along the pipeline route. One young filmmaker and journalist has taken an interest in the Energy East pipeline and has taken part in two of the open houses the company has put on to acquaint the public with the project. She spoke to me recently about her concerns.
My name is Crystal Green. I live in Winnipeg, and my family comes from Shoal Lake, which is just east of Winnipeg, and it's where Winnipeg gets its drinking water from. This pipeline that they want to convert is very old. It's an antique pipeline, which is part of the Canadian mainline of natural gas line pipes. And these pipelines were not designed for carrying tar sands bitumen.
On their website, TransCanada boasts of its excellent safety record. It mentioned, for example, its use of high-quality steel and best construction practices when building pipelines. It stated the pipelines are monitored 24 hours a day and that they were cathodically protected to inhibit corrosion. And it cited statistics from the U.S. Department of Transportation confirming the age of a pipeline is not a leading cause of leaks. Crystal Green was not convinced.
Their pipeline, their Keystone pipeline, in its first year, there were 12 spills. So to me, TransCanada and a lot of these pipeline companies don't have, like, they don't have a good track record in my mind because of all these ruptures and spills. And so I just don't think it's worth the risk.
Crystal was also not impressed by the open houses that the company put on to acquaint stakeholders with the endeavor.
Okay, well, I've been to two open houses. The problem with these open houses is that, like, when you're looking around at all the other people in the room who are there to ask questions and talk with the TransCanada reps, you don't exactly get to hear what the other people are saying. So you're stuck one-on-one with a TransCanada representative. And I feel that it kind of alienates oneself from other people who are there with the same concerns. Like, it's a very controlled setting where they're guiding and they're kind of, you know, telling you what you want, like what they think you want to hear. And it just, every time I asked a question, like, they wouldn't give me a straight answer.
The following exchange between TransCanada representative Philippe Canon and a member of the public was recorded by Crystal at the March 18th consultation in Winnipeg.
Last year, this year, we've invested $1 billion in our safety infrastructure program, but only for pipelines. So we take this very, very seriously. It's something that we do, and we don't cut corners on security.
How does it work? Where does it go if there's a leak?
Well, it would actually stay in the pipeline depending on the type of field we're looking at, depending on where the pump station is, depending on if where, because you're saying it's a pipe rupture and everything would flow out. It doesn't work like that.
I felt that he was downplaying the potential for spills, and I also felt he was downplaying the risks to people along the pipeline route in the event of a spill. he wasn't able to answer the question that I asked, which was what happens in the event of a spill. He was almost suggesting that the oil would stay in the pipeline. That's never happened before. I don't know why it would happen in this event.
Pipeline open houses will continue through April and May in provinces east of Manitoba. For more information, check out the company's website, energyeastpipeline.com. In Winnipeg, from the heart of occupied Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Niiwak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
That report was recorded in the CKUW studio by Michael Welch. His guest, Crystal Green, supplied the audio from the March 18th consultation. A Queen's University student involved in the opposition to the Men's Issues Awareness Society was assaulted outside her home on March the 26th. The student, who is female, had been actively involved in the campaign to de-ratify the Men's Issues Awareness Society prior to their first scheduled event. The attacker, who is male, is reported to have known her name but has yet to be identified. Before the assault happened, the student who wishes to remain anonymous had been receiving threatening emails due to her feminist politics. The event featuring Dr. Janice Fiamengo was sponsored by CAFE, the Canadian Association for Equality, and included representatives of the website of A Voice for Men. A Voice for Men, a U.S.-based website, is notorious for disseminating personal information of people who dispute their arguments.
Dana Wesley, who is a part of CFRC's News Collective, spoke with Brea, the coordinator of OPER Kingston, about the recent events on campus.
Can you speak a little bit about the assault on campus previous to the actual event that happened?
I can't speak too much to it. Like, there's a student on campus who received some threatening emails calling her out for some of her feminist work and her work trying to de-ratify this group as a recognized campus group. And what I can speak to is, like, after her attack, although the police have acknowledged there's no formal recognition between the Men's Issues Awareness Society and the attack, it's just, you know, so people don't like her feminism and they've threatened to attack her. That coincidence is there. It certainly added a sense of silencing on campus, or threatening silence on campus. What does it mean to have, you know, women or, you know, like, anyone attacked for their politics in a visceral, physical way?
And what was the community response to this, the assaults, or, like, the events in general?
Well, the community response right now has been robust. It's been beautiful. I was talking to someone the other day, and she said, I think Queen's had the most mature response. I'm not sure if I'm quite there yet to believe if we had the most mature response yet, but we had an alternative space to the Janice lecture. We at the Gray House, which is one of the old centers of organizing, feminist organizing on campus, we just packed it full, 100 people. It was unfortunately packed and hot and sweaty, but we are there all celebrating and happy to take part in our feminist politic. It kind of, like, we don't need to, like, reject her because her words speak against her just by himself. We've also had really, like, robust community response. We reached out to the community and we said, what happens on campus, like, if men's rights language and ideology starts to foster on campus, it will make its way to to the community. It will start attacking or, you know, delegitimizing sexual assault centers or other feminist-based groups. So we've had a pretty comprehensive approach. We have the community is putting on a lecture tomorrow with Jacqueline Friedman, talking about yes means yes and talking about a more affirmative consent culture. It's exciting.
And what has the Queen's University institutional response been like?
The faculties, and Gender Studies faculty in particular, has been really strong. You know, they've come out and they said really clearly that they want, you know, a campus that includes feminist organizing, that they stand in support of people who are organizing against the Men's Issues Awareness Society. The administration, on the other hand, has made a statement saying they want a safe and welcoming space to have academic discourse. What does that mean? What is the practicality of that? It's been kind of left open. I do know that there are some people within the administration who are pressuring the higher-ups to make a strong and solid statement, but we'll find out if they're successful upcoming.
And do you know if there are any plans for, you know, future organizing around this kind of thing?
Well, men's rights organizing is becoming stronger and more pronounced across every province. And so we have acknowledged feminist campus groups and feminist community groups that we can't just let this issue die. Like we have to bring it up. We're not just reacting to this one event. We're actually going to make a consistent response challenging these really problematic politics.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
Groundwire National Coordinator Carly Forbes spoke with Frieda Werden, co-founder of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, about her upcoming retirement from CJSF.
I had the honor of speaking with Frieda Werden about some of her accomplishments in community radio. I asked her about how she first got started in radio.
Well, I was walking down the street one day in Austin, Texas, and I ran across a man I used to work with who was putting gasoline in his car at the gas station. And I said, "Hello, Stuart. How are you doing? What are you doing these days?" And he said, "I'm the program director at Longhorn Radio Network." I said, "Oh, radio, do you need any help?" He said, "Yes, we need somebody to produce a series about women's liberation." I said, "Tell me more." And that was how I became the producer, although I wasn't the interviewer at that time, for a series called Women Today or something like that. And he asked me, "Do you want to distribute it? Do you want to distribute it nationally or statewide?" And I said, "Well, there's a lot happening in Texas right now. Let's distribute it statewide." So it was only distributed statewide, but it was probably the first syndicated radio program about the women's movement in the United States. That was in 1973. I had the good luck to start with the radio about women and primarily been doing radio about women, at least in my own work, ever since. And I should mention also that after that, I produced a series called What's Normal, which was nationally distributed. It was 13 half-hour radio programs about homosexual lifestyles. And that was the first syndicated program about gay people in the United States.
I asked her about any advice that she has for young women journalists who are just getting started.
Well, a couple of things. I think that it really is worth it to go the extra mile to get the voices that are seldom heard. That often means women, because still a lot of women will say, "Oh, I'm not the expert. Talk to him," you know, something like that. But you know, it's worth it to try to convince the women to speak. Women have great voices. When I was first starting, they used to say women didn't have good radio voices, that the mic did not like women's voices. But I think we've got some mics that like women's voices now, if we didn't always. And I wanted to say that back in the 80s, after we first started WINGS, we applied for some federal funding from the United States. And it was right after the United Nations Third World Conference on Women. And a lot of coverage had come out of the global women's movement for about a minute and then disappeared. And so when we applied for funding, we were told, "This is an idea whose time has passed. That programming about women was passé already." And that is so not true. And the fact that we've had WINGS going for 28 years is some indication of that. It's still carried on a lot of stations. But I think that look for the women and look for what the women's movement is doing. There's so much that needs to be covered. I always say that WINGS is just a drop in the bucket of the coverage that's needed of the women's movement, but that our achievement is that at least if there's a drop in the bucket, you know what water is.
Frieda is about to retire from her position as public affairs coordinator at CJSF in Burnaby, BC. And she reflected a bit on her experiences working in campus and community radio in Canada.
That my experience at CJSF has been really wonderful. It's the first time that I had a salaried position in community radio, even though I've been involved in community radio all this time. And it's just been so great to be working with community radio people so closely all the time, and to see people come into radio and develop their skills and their personalities develop too. You know, people tell me this, that they get over being shy, they feel more confident. And community radio is is just a great endeavor for everyone involved, and it's been my privilege and pleasure to be involved in it at CJSF, at the national level, you know, just as attending conferences of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, and at the international level, where I've been an officer from time to time of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, AMARC. And I'd just like to add that AMARC is having a conference. They have one every 4 years, and one's coming up in Ghana in December. And I'd like to urge listeners who are involved in community radio to go to that and to discover that community radio is a worldwide movement and that we have so much to learn from each other.
You just heard In the Sound by Free Love Fenner from Montreal, Quebec.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by CFRC on traditional Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe territory in Kingston, Ontario.
Music this week was by Dorothea Paz and Free Love Fenner.
Headlines this week were written by Ed Von Adderkas, Carly Forbes, Amelie Philipson, and Frida Werden.
We'd also like to thank Michael Welch and Dana Wesley.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.